Hi, it's Diane. On my mind, massive wildfires in Australia.
Across southeastern Australia this morning, a heat wave and strong winds are fueling a state of emergency.
The terrifying scale of Australia's bushfire disaster is beginning to emerge.
An eerie glow hangs over Eden Harbour as residents walk through thick smoke in the middle of the day.
The fires, which began in September, have burnt through an area of almost 18 million acres, the size of Denmark and Belgium combined. They've destroyed thousands of homes, killed more than 20 people, and taken the lives of millions of animals. As we begin this new decade, the fires are a stark reminder of the world's lack of action on climate change and its consequences. I spoke with David Wallace Wells, deputy editor and climate columnist for New York Magazine. David, describe for us what the fires in Australia currently look like.
Well, we've heard a lot about the fires in New South Wales, which is the region of the country that is right outside of Sydney. But actually, there are fires all across the country, which is to say all across the continent. Australia is, you know, we think of it as one country. It's about the size of the entire continental U.S. And there are bushfires burning in almost every district in the entire country. The ones in New South Wales are the most dramatic, in part because they're around some of the most populated areas. But the entire country is, practically speaking, on fire. And those fires have been burning, depending on how you count, as long as since early September. The really big ones around New South Wales have been burning since mid-October, which means they've now been burning for about 2 months straight. And in the U.S., we're used to thinking of wildfire in the California context, where there's a months-long fire season, but any particular fire burns for only really a couple of days or at most a week. The Paradise Fire from a few years ago that burned the campfire, I should say, in Paradise, California, burned for just 4 hours. The fires in Australia are burning with that kind of intensity, but they're burning now for a period of months at a time. Firefighters and now the military that's been drawn in to help fight the fires have made basically no progress in containing them. They're, practically speaking, entirely uncontrolled. They've burned something like 20 million acres now, which is about 25 times the size of the biggest California fire season on record. Estimates are that they've killed as many as 1 billion animals. A few dozen people, destroyed thousands of homes, forced the evacuation of many thousands of people living in quite densely urban areas of the country, and giving the whole eastern coast of Australia a haze of orange smog, which on certain days has been as much as 100 times more hazardous. You know, the air has been 100 times more polluted than it's considered safe to breathe. This smoke has traveled as far as New Zealand, turning the color of its glaciers first gray and then pink, and in fact has traveled all the way to South America, 7,000 miles away. You can see the smoke from the fires from satellite images. It is an unprecedented fire disaster on a planet that is suffering more and more fire disasters now thanks to the transformations of climate change. And I think it's a real harbinger and a portent of the kind of horrifying climate future that we're all headed towards in decades ahead, although Australia is getting there first and tragically.
Do I understand correctly that you have only volunteer firefighters?
Up until this point, the firefighting force in Australia has been dominated by volunteers. They have some professional firefighters, but it hasn't been the bulk of those people fighting the fires. And they've just over the last few days mobilized the military. In fact, it's the largest mobilization of the Australian military since World War II. So we're seeing a war footing, the country getting on a war footing to fight these fires. So at the moment, that dynamic is changing. But for the last few months, it's been dominated by volunteers. I should say that may seem horrifying. In California, it's the place in the U.S. where we have the most experience fighting wildfire. The Cal Fire firefighting force features an enormous number of inmates who are conscripted from California prisons and paid as little as a dollar a day to fight the fire. So in many of these cases all around the world, because wildfires are so devastating, terrifying, and because they're ultimately in large part uncontrollable, CAL FIRE, the California Fire Department, says that they've never been able to stop a wildfire that was powered by Santa Ana winds, never in the entire history of the department. The best they can hope for is for the winds to just change. The people that end up being put in the path of the fire are, it's not a professional firefighting force. It's those who are protecting their own homes, protecting their own yes. communities, or in the case of the California situation, inmates who have no other choice.
Now, in California and elsewhere, some of these fires have been attributed to human carelessness. Is there any such cause that began the fire in Australia?
Those investigations are still ongoing. I think it's likely that at least some of the fires were started by either arson or human accident, campfire, lit cigarette, that kind of thing. That's not at all unusual. Wildfires, they can sometimes start by lightning strike, oftentimes a downed power line in some kind of a storm or weather event, wind event. But they're also often started by human fault, human error. And in general, these are quite complicated systems, wildfires. They're essentially whole weather systems. And the spark is only one ingredient to producing a really dramatic fire event. The other ingredients have to do with the particular weather conditions in the, that day, but also the weather conditions over a period of months and even years, which have produced whatever amount of brush there is to burn. And so even when a particular fire, we can say definitively, was caused by human action, it's still the case that climate change is making those fires much, much worse. And apologies for keeping coming back to California. It's the example I know best. But in California, we've had basically the same number of ignition events over the last five decades. Those have held steady. Some of them are natural. Some of them are man-made. But the number of ignition events has held constant. And yet the acreage has grown fivefold. And that growth of acreage burned is a result of the climate transformations to the landscape. We're seeing similar things in Australia. It may well be that some of these biggest fires turn out to have been caused, we can say definitively, by human action, human error. But nevertheless, the main driver of the fire disaster is climate change and environmental conditions, not the spark itself, which is ultimately sort of just a random event.
And the temperatures right now in various parts of Australia, 106, 107, is that normal for this time of year?
Well, it's actually below what some of the temperatures were a week or two ago, where they set records in consecutive days. They got up to about 120 in large parts of the country, and the average for the entire country was well over 100. So these are unusually warm temperatures. They're not at the moment record-setting temperatures, but it's one reason why the fires are so devastating, because of the heat and the dry conditions that they're living through right now. It makes the bush much more flammable.
Help me to understand the impact not only on the land and the animals, but on the human beings themselves.
There are several different aspects of that. The one that concerns me most is the smoke from the wildfires. Now, there are two things to understand about the smoke from wildfires. The first is that it actually is carbon. Plant life is like coal. It stores carbon, and when it burns, it releases carbon. So these fires in Australia will, by the time they're finished, have at least doubled the annual carbon emissions of the entire Australian country. That means that they will have produced as much CO2 emissions as the entire country and its entire economy and industry for the entire year. That's terrible for the outlook of the future of the planet. And it's one of what scientists call the feedback loops that they're most worried about, that because warming conditions would produce more fires, we would also end up producing more carbon, which produces more warming. But there are direct health effects of that smoke too. And those are quite scary and concerning. And it's one of the aspects of this situation, I think, that is not quite so well understood yet. Millions of people around the world die every year from air pollution of this kind. In places like Australia, the US, and the EU, it's not often all that common. But even low levels of exposure to this kind of smoke can affect your cognition, can affect your breathing, can affect heart disease. It affects the development of children in utero and growth of babies after they're born. It produces higher rates of premature birth and low birth weight. Every aspect of human health and mental health is affected by breathing this air. Schizophrenia attacks go up, and rates of admission to mental hospitals go up. when there's this kind of smoke in the air. And we're talking about smoke now covering basically the entire east coast of that continent for a period of months. So it's not just a short-term exposure. It's a quite long-term exposure.
How many people have actually left the country because of these fires?
That I don't know off the top of my head, but I do know that there have been refugee evacuations in communities numbering in the tens of thousands, many of them. So the number of people who are displaced, at least internally, I would say would surely, you know, rise above 100,000. Most of the continent is very, very sparsely inhabited. There's Perth on the west coast, and there's some settlements in the interior, but they're quite small. Basically, the country's population is concentrated on the developed east coast, and that makes the encounter of that part of the country with these fires most dramatic, because it's one thing to imagine some scrubland or some forest land where nobody lives burning, another thing to see, you know, hills towering just above Sydney or just above Melbourne on fire, and that's what we're seeing this fire season. I think that the internal displacement has been, you know, people are moving in a bunch of different directions to a bunch of different places. The truth is that the interior of the country doesn't have infrastructure to support all that much resettlement. I think most of the movement has been of relatively short distance, and that's true of natural disaster displacement and climate displacement more generally. Sometimes when we hear about the quite dramatic projections for climate migration in the decades ahead, the UN thinks that by 2050, we could have 200 million climate refugees, for instance. We think that that means that everybody's going to be leaving South Asia and the Middle East and coming up to Russia and Europe. Most displacement from natural disaster and climate pressure happens locally. People just move, you know, 10, 20 miles away to the next town over, that's a little bit safer.
Now a quick break. When we come back, more about Australia's fires from David Wallace Wells.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the district, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily.
Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Now, here's the rest of my conversation with David Wallace Wells. He's deputy editor and climate columnist for New York Magazine. He's the author of the book titled The Uninhabitable Earth. Tell me how the politicians in Australia are responding, most especially the Prime Minister.
The Prime Minister, Scott Morrison, was elected last year, or re-elected last year, in a campaign that he won by surprise, in part by emphasizing the cost of taking action on climate change. It was actually an election, unlike many other that we've seen in the West, that have deprioritized climate issues. This was an election that sort of hung on the question of whether the country should be more aggressive taking action on climate and decarbonization. And his opponent was expected to win running on a campaign focused on decarbonization and taking action on climate change. And Morrison won a surprise re-election by saying that that would be too expensive and too problematic. So he is in the sort of model of Donald Trump in the U.S. and Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, to a lesser extent, Putin in Russia, people who see themselves as opponents of aggressive climate action and have made that a part of their public profile. And he's honored that during this disaster. It's been quite a, to my mind, grotesque display of public leadership, because the country is in an unprecedented natural disaster crisis that has now been unfolding for several months. And he has spent most of that time basically indifferent to that crisis, because he has so boxed himself in as at least a climate skeptic, if not an outright denier. Now, he's, over the last couple of weeks, taken a slightly more aggressive posture. He came back from a two-week vacation he took in Hawaii during some of the most intense burning, and has mobilized the military. So he's beginning to sort of take action, at least on you know, at the level of trying to protect the citizens of Australia rather than hanging them out to dry, as had been the case for the 6 weeks before. But I think the country as a whole has seen his behavior as sort of reprehensible and indifferent. And I think he'll be paying quite a dramatic political price in the weeks and months ahead. I think that his popularity is likely never to recover because he's done such a poor job. Even putting aside the question of Australia's long-term carbon trajectory, he's done such a poor job simply managing the fact of the natural disaster, making sure that people who need to be evacuated are evacuated in a timely and orderly way, and keeping the citizens of the country safe, not to mention the ecological devastation that's come through the whole country, you know, wiping out whole ecosystems and pushing many animal species to the brink of extinction. This is, you know, obviously a lesser concern than the life of humans, but still something that Australians care very much about.
Of course. And in fact, didn't he come back somewhat reluctantly?
From his vacation? Yeah.
Yes.
He sort of pretended that he wasn't on vacation, and then he got outed and he had to return. It was just, I mean, really terrible political optics to put aside even the direct suffering that he was helping cause. I mean, just to be lying on the beach while the country burns.
In fact, there were climate talks in Madrid just last month, and I gather Australia was one of the parties, including the United States, thwarting those climate talks.
One of the sticking points is that Australia was basically trying to, it's sort of technical and complicated to explain, but they wanted to use credits that they had built up in previous climate treaties, basically to make it seem as though they were meeting their commitments under more recent climate treaties. And that basically torpedoed all of the progress that could have been made at those talks in Madrid. And they were not the only nation that torpedoed those talks. The U.S. played a crippling role as well, and several other nations too. But Australia, you know, they're a particularly visible saboteur of this ongoing international negotiation, because they are the first world country, at least, that is being hit with the most intense climate impacts. In general, climate change is hitting the developing world first and most intensely, and that will probably continue. That's what science expect to see happen, that it'll be the global south that's always hit hardest. Australia is sort of the one outlier there. They're the one really wealthy nation in the world that is dealing with a kind of climate change impacts that are otherwise only hitting the poor nations of the world. And so it's an especially important case study in how the wealthy West will respond to climate change going forward. And the results, at least from Australia, are quite dispiriting. The politics has moved away from climate action rather than in the right direction. It may be that these wildfires turn things around, but that remains to be seen.
You had the Guardian newspaper put it this way: Australia took a match to UN climate talks while back home the country burned.
You can't argue with that perspective. You know, I think if you look at the public opinion polls in Australia, most of the public believes climate change is real. Most of the public is concerned about it. And most even say that they want their government to be acting quite aggressively, first to decarbonize and also to combat the impacts of climate change. The problem is that that doesn't always translate when those people are going to the polls and voting for their leaders. And I worry that that pattern will be replicated elsewhere around the world. In the U.S., depending on how you ask the question, somewhere between 70 and 80% of Americans are concerned about climate change. And yet we have a climate skeptic in the White House who may well be reelected next year. That's true also across Europe. The numbers in the polls are quite strong. They say they see climate change as a kind of an near-term existential threat. And yet in very few countries of the world are there even political parties that are really prioritizing action on climate. And that disjuncture could really be problematic going forward, where people are concerned, the public is concerned, but it takes a very long time for our politics to respond, if it ever does, leaving us basically out to dry.
Considering that Australia usually encounters cooler weather and rain as the year moves on, are you optimistic that these fires will in fact die down fairly soon?
I think the scientists expect that they will be burning somewhat dramatically at least through the end of this month. In January, you know, January is sort of peak summer for Australia. So we're just heading into the real fire season. I don't expect that this is going to be a permanent feature of, you know, Australian life to begin with. The more dramatic the fires are, the less bush they'll leave behind for future fire seasons to burn. That's one of the sort of perverse products of such a devastating fire season, that the next years are likely to be much less dramatic because there simply isn't anything there to burn anymore.
That leaves the land itself pretty devastated.
Absolutely. No, I mean, it would be crippling for agriculture, especially for the sort of national forests and protected wildlife in the country. Many of those forests have been totally devastated. It's one reason why the loss of animal life has been so dramatic, because many of the places that have burned most quickly have been nature preserves. And that is you know, quite concerning, quite distressing, quite depressing for the country. But it also means that in the next few years, they may have some kind of reprieve. But in the big picture, climate change means that we're going to be having many more of these kinds of fire events going forward much more regularly. The heat wave that Australia had a few weeks ago, where they set really dramatic heat records on consecutive days, at the moment, that was considered a once-in-a-century event. But at about one more degree of warming, scientists say, which I think is about an inevitable level of warming, it would become just a once-in-a-decade event. So we're likely to see that 10 times more often than we do today.
This is something that seems very minor in the larger picture, but I am planning to travel by boat to Australia in mid-March. What would your prediction be in terms of weather and smoke and ash by then?
My guess is that by then the fires will have been contained and died down, but will not have been entirely defeated, and that there probably will be some air issues, but not nearly as dramatic as they are today. But it's really ultimately to be determined. It's hard to make predictions that far out because it really depends on how the weather evolves. And it's hard to know that really more than a few days out with any certainty. But given the rhythms of the fire season in the past, I would expect that things would be subsiding by then, but not entirely extinguished.
Do you think Australia will adapt to these fires, to these rising temperatures, and accommodate? Or do you believe that Australia could become doomed because of rising temperatures and climate change?
I tend to think that it's hard to bet against the adaptability and resilience of the human species. The question is, what are we adapting to? What level of suffering are we accommodating ourselves to? If the country is dealing with fires like these, say once a decade, that doesn't mean that life can't continue there, but it will mean that life will be quite damaged and degraded, and that there will be quite a lot more human suffering than today we would consider acceptable or conscionable. And I think in general, that's the pattern we're likely to see with climate change generally. We'll be able to adapt to some things with new technology and new political approaches. We'll be able to protect ourselves from some impacts, but also we'll simply decide to define certain levels of suffering, which once seemed unacceptable, as newly acceptable in our brave new climate world. And that's a tragedy, and it's an indictment of our inaction, but I think it's also, practically speaking, an inevitability. It's the way that we respond to human suffering for the most part today, not by eradicating it, but accommodating ourselves to it. And that's, you know, the dynamic that I'm most worried about going forward.
David, thank you for being with us.
Thanks for having me. Great to talk.
And that's all for today. Find us on Facebook and Twitter, or send us an email, drpodcast@wamu.org. Our theme music is composed by Jim Brunberg and Ben Landsberg of Wonderly. The show is produced by Rebecca Kaufman and Allison Brody. Our engineers this week are Cliff Gallagher and Natalie Yerv-Libker. Thanks for listening, all. I'm Diane Rehm.